From the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning, and welcome back to the second hour, Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Dansel, Jason Croft is at the control. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be doing our monthly show on children's health, and our guest will be Dr. Robert Bocek. He's here every month, always on a Thursday, and we'll take whatever questions you have about children. So if the kids in question are your kids, nieces and nephews, grandkids, what have you, any of the kinds of things that you could discuss with the pediatrician, that would be fair game on tomorrow morning's program. Then in the second hour, our guest is investigative journalist James Bamford. He's written a lot about intelligence gathering. He's written a couple of books on the National Security Agency, and we will talk about his most recent book, which is titled A Pretext of War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus, we have a healthcare topic for you, something that we do generally once a year, and have been doing for quite a few years now. And our guest is Dr. Jim Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon from Carl Clinic, and we'll be talking about the back and care of the back. And so if you have questions, they are welcome. And I know the doctor would do his best to give you an answer. I want to make sure that people know. I always say every time we have a doctor on the show, I say the same thing. I just want to make sure people understand we can't diagnose over the telephone. There are some limits as to what we can do because the doctor can't see you. And obviously, if you have health concerns, you need to pursue that with a doctor who can. But this is a place to start. We do these shows to try to add to your store of health knowledge and to give you a starting point. So I don't want to discourage anybody from calling. If you have questions about the back, give us a call. It is 333-9455. We also do have that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be back, David.
I think probably almost every time we've done this, I have probably asked you to do the same thing at the beginning, but I think it helps to understand what can go wrong with the back for you to give people a little tour of particularly of the spine and how it's constructed, because then if they understand that, then it will be easier for them to visualize, understand what can possibly go wrong. So maybe I'll ask you to do that and talk just a little bit about the structure of it and what it's made of, how it goes together.
Most people know that their spine is made of bone, and in fact, there are bone building blocks stacked one on another that make up the space between the head and the tailbone, so to speak. Between these blocks of bone are discs, and those discs are shock absorbers and allow the spine to move as well as to absorb energy. In the back of the spine are joints called facet joints, and those allow some stability to the spine but preserve motion. In the center of the spine is the spinal canal, and that's the space that transmits the spinal cord and nerves so that signals can get from the brain through the neck, thoracic spine, lumbar spine, and sacrum out to the rest of the body. My theory is that people ought to have perfect health until they're 100 and then fall into a pile of dust. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work that way. And in fact, things can go wrong with the spine. If you have a disc aging before its time, if one of those shock absorbers is giving out prematurely, that classically gives backache with activity. If a person has arthritis in those joints in the back of the spine, that can classically give soreness and stiffness when in one position for a long time. There are other conditions, such as herniated disc, where there can be pressure on the nerves or spinal cord, that would classically give radiating extremity symptoms. Obviously, such things as fractures do happen. Tumors occasionally happen in the spine. There are all sorts of maladies that I get to deal with to try to help people function and reduce their pain. Mm. So those are the structures that we're going to be talking about today.
Okay. And how much is the result of a natural kind of aging process, and how much might have something to do either with lifestyle or with misuse, that is an injury that comes from either overuse, improper lifting, straining, you know, that kind of thing?
Currently, we can't answer that question with the certainty that we'd all like. We do know that there are a number of factors involved. The first trick is to choose good parents. We think that there's a genetic predisposition to many spine problems. Certainly that's true for certain types of arthritis of the spine. It's true for the discs aging before their time. There are a number of conditions, including scoliosis or lateral curvature of the spine, that have a genetic component. And then there's the traumatic component, as you've mentioned. We know that people that play collision sports as youngsters, I guess as adults too, have a higher incidence of back problems. So if you're a football player, an aggressive soccer player, a very aggressive basketball player, you're more likely to have back problems in life. One of the ones that I talk about often is cigarette smoking. There's a high association between cigarette smoking and back problems. It is thought that cigarette smoking causes the discs in the spine to age prematurely. People who are more than 20% over ideal weight have a higher incidence of back problems. People that don't get regular exercise have a higher incidence of back problems. It is thought that those that spend more than an hour and a half in a vehicle per day, those that have a sitting job and don't exercise regularly, also have a propensity for back complaints. So those are some of the factors involved.
We have one caller here ready to go. Someone else is calling in, and take as many as we can. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Jim Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon from Carle Clinic. And we'll start with Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about my son, who is 17, who is 6'3" and rather lanky, I would say. And he's been complaining for some months now, really, really bad lower back pain. We originally went to our regular doctor who put him on some anti-inflammatories and assumed it was some sort of injury, although there wasn't a specific injury that seemed to precipitate this. It didn't go away, so then he was sent to a physical therapist who did some, you know, electrical stim and gave him some stretching exercises because told him he thought the basic reason for the problem was muscle tightness. Especially, he said the psoas area was very tight, and he thought it was, you know, doing it. He didn't think there was any serious disc problem or anything like that. However, the pain has continued, and he describes it as pain but also real stiffness. And this is the first time in his life he's had this, and I'm wondering if you have anything to say about that.
Yes. For a 17-year-old, there are a number of things that come to mind. First of all, let me say that your primary care doctor is on the right track by trying some of the temporary things that would make him feel more comfortable while he's waiting for his body to get over this. Arthritis medication makes sense. When a person is not making progress, then it makes sense to send them to the physical therapist for an exercise program. I don't know the electrical stim would do much, but certainly a stretching program and exercises to strengthen the abdominal and back muscles can be quite helpful. Mm-hmm. If a person doesn't make progress by doing those fairly simple, straightforward things, then further investigation is warranted. Mm-hmm. Certainly, if he's not had one, a regular x-ray would be appropriate. Mm-hmm. If the regular x-ray shows the problem, it can be dealt with. If it doesn't show the problem and your son is having more than just a mild irritating pain, it would be worthwhile to go through a scan of some sort, and the MRI would be the best choice.
Okay.
If back problems run in the family, it could be a degenerating disc causing his problem. We know about 10% of 10-year-olds and 15% of 15-year-olds have some back symptoms that can be traced to degenerative disc disease. A 17-year-old is also in the adolescent time, and there is a condition of the back called a spondylolysis, which is a crack at the bottom of the spine that's thought to be a stress fracture. Happens particularly in athletes, but it can happen just from walking. So that would be a pain in the back, occasionally in the thighs, can give tight hamstrings, and is often made worse by backward bending. So I would say your son has done the initial things that most people get better with. Since he did not improve, it's time for some further investigation.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And we will continue next. We have a caller in Champaign County, and this is line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I had a L5-S1. I guess that's the most common ruptured disc. And I had good results with a deep cortisone injection. And I'm just wondering, Does it make sense to ask about the kind of results that people have, or is that every case is different, but statistics, do a lot of cases go that far? And one of the problems they had at the time is, getting the injection in exactly the right spot. I had something called iontophoresis till the HMO denied it a while back for a different ailment, which was also an inflammation in a soft tissue area. And I'm wondering whether any of that applies one way or the other, or do you get my drift?
Absolutely. Actually, herniated disc at L4, L5, which is the second disc from the bottom, is a little more common than L5S1.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not too far off, and L5S1 is the second most common. A herniated disc means that you got a crack in the covering of the disc called the annulus, and some of the soft center disc material has come out and gone into the spinal canal and is rubbing on a nerve. The body generally can handle this pretty well. It's no fun to start with, but we think that the disc material does not belong in the spinal canal, and there are certain chemicals in it that call in white blood cells. White blood cells migrate out of the veins in the spinal canal and secrete enzymes that digest this piece of disc. So 80% of people who have a herniated disc in the lower back get better on their own and start getting better within 6 to 12 weeks. Most of us, however, don't want to wait in pain 6 to 12 weeks, and so temporary things to help out make a lot of sense. If it's my back, I do exactly what you did, and that is get an epidural steroid injection. By putting a long-acting cortisone-like drug around the nerve that's irritated, that can help for weeks or months. Doesn't cure anything, but it makes you more comfortable while you're waiting for your body to get over it.
Excuse me, may I interrupt? Because I was understanding that it also, by taking down the inflammation, it actually let the disc dry up so that it did have something other than symptomatic relief, that it actually does help. Is that not the case? Or
many of us doctors have ways of explaining to patients what's going on, and oftentimes we simplify. Mm-hmm. From a strict medical point of view, there is no evidence that an epidural steroid injection will shrink the disc or affect the course of the disease in any way. If you're going to get better on your own, you do. If you're not going to get better on your own, you don't. It merely makes you more comfortable while you're waiting for that to happen.
I see. So as far as the idea of getting in the right area and not having to go in for another one, you I guess you kind of discount that as long as you... But what about the idea that this corticosteroids are limited in their use because they can have some degenerative effects of their own? Isn't that not right?
Oh, you're correct on both counts. I think that it's important to get the injection in the correct spot. If you have a herniated disc at L5S1 and somebody gives you an injection at L3, L4,
well, yeah, I meant
it's not going to help.
More specific to the – I don't know how broad the – I mean, obviously not operating on the wrong leg kind of thing, but just
right.
Getting it in the right area.
If you're nearby, it usually works out pretty well because the medication, when injected, does diffuse an inch or so in every direction. So it's not that you have to be within 1 millimeter, but certainly you need to be within 1 inch of the right spot.
Mm-hmm.
The what was the other point?
Deterioration by corticosteroids?
Oh, yes. Most injectionists, and they're usually rehab medicine doctors or anesthesiologists that do these kind of injections, will not give more than 3 injections per year because they're worried about the total steroid dose you might get. So it's not like a knee where if you give too many injections, it ruins the cartilage in the knee because it's really not going into the cartilage area when it goes into your back. But some of the steroid is absorbed into the circulation, so it goes throughout the body, only a small amount of it. But too many injections in the back are not good. Also, the second injection generally doesn't help as much as the first. The third injection doesn't help as much as the second. So there are some limitations from a practical point of view as well.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Right. We will continue, and the next caller is in Aurora on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Is there any medication that you can take? I don't mean medication. Is there any vitamin or some plus? I hate to use the word medication because I mean a vitamin type thing that would aid in the back or and other bones also in the body?
Yes and no. There is certainly no magic pill that will take your spine from being 60 years old to being 20 years old. But there are a number of medications and vitamins and minerals that have been used that can be quite helpful. For example, if you have pain in the back, arthritis medications or muscle relaxants or pain pills can be quite helpful. If you have sensitive nerves, nerve medication can be used. If you have osteoporosis or lack of calcium in your bone, which happens to usually thin white female cigarette smokers whose mother had osteoporosis, then taking calcium and vitamin D can be quite helpful when coupled with an exercise program. There are now bone hormones that are available to help females, and males for that matter, deposit more calcium in the bones. There are no over-the-counter medications that have been scientifically shown to make a difference other than the calcium and vitamin D that I mentioned. If you are vitamin deficient in vitamin C or some of the other vitamins, then you could have potentially deleterious or bad effects on the bones and the musculoskeletal system in general. But right now, that's what's available.
I am very fortunate. I'm an older person and I have no back pain, and I hate to say that, but I want to keep it that way. My other question is there an exercise, if you have a well back, that will aid it?
Absolutely. And in fact, you're lucky that you don't have any back problems. Sounds like if you're elderly, then you're over 50, like
yes.
I am.
Yes.
And exercise is the single most important thing you can do for a happy back. Ideally, you would put in a few minutes a day on flexibility exercises. Ideally, you'd put in a few minutes a day on something to firm up the abdominal and back muscles. And then ideally 3 to 5 times a week, even more if you wanted to, you'd do something for your overall cardiovascular fitness. I recommend walking 2 to 3 miles a day as an exercise that most people can do to keep their backs healthy.
Sounds very good, and thank you much. Yes, I know that I'm very fortunate to have the back I have. Thank you.
Okay,
you're welcome.
Thank you.
We're getting good questions today.
All right. Well, we'll just keep on going. Maybe I'll give our number again, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. We're talking about the back and care of the back, and our guest is Dr. Jim Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon from Carle Clinic in Urbana. Hidalgo, I think, is the next caller here. That would be line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I had I first started with my hands getting numb and then my left leg, and so I went to Dr. Pensy up in Springfield, and he fused 5 of my lower back, and he said in my neck I'd had some kind of an injury, and they fused 3 of my up there in my neck, and then this has been about 3 years ago, and I still have numb hands and numb feet, and I'm taking Neurontin 3 times a day, and I take Ativan 2 a day. Is there anything else that might be better than that for that kind of problem? Because I had so much calcium build up that they had a lot of problems there getting it kind of cleaned out to where it didn't affect my spinal cord too much.
It sounds like you have a complicated problem. When the hands and feet go numb, certainly that can come from the spine, and the neck could be the complete cause of it. Or in your case, you could have a problem in your lower back with spurs poking on the nerves, and in the neck with spurs and disc bulges poking on the nerves and spinal cord. It sounds like the fact that you're on Neurontin, which is a very good nerve medication, means that the surgeon thought that there was a problem with the nerves themselves or a residual where the pressure on the nerves and spinal cord may have caused some permanent changes that your body is having trouble accommodating to. It sounds like your doctor did a spinal fusion because he had to take out so much bone that he was afraid you would fall apart if he did not. I think that the diagnosis is in question based on what you're telling me. It could be that there's some residual pressure on a nerve. It could be that the nerves themselves are the problem, or it could be a combination. If you've not already done so, I think you should talk to your primary care doctor about visiting with a neurologist. That's a medical nerve doctor who can test out the nerves, and he might find that, gee, you've got carpal tunnel syndrome as well as your old neck problem causing your hand numbness. Or he might say, gee, you're not on a therapeutic dose of Neurontin, or maybe we need to add another medication in addition to the Neurontin. So I wouldn't give up and live with it at this point. I would visit with a neurologist if it were my neck and my back to see if anything else could be done.
Well, it seemed like it's affecting my kidneys and some other problems there.
Well, I would start with my primary care doctor if kidneys are involved, but I think that you're going to want to make a stop to the neurologist if you've not already done so. And the neurologist would then send you back to your surgeon if he found something that surgery could help, or would make some suggestions for you and your doctor about other medications.
It seems like at times, like my hands and things are not as bad as others. I don't know what causes that, but it seems like sometimes they're halfway livable and other times they're pretty irritating.
Well, that's a good sign, because what comes and goes can often be treated, and what comes and stays is harder to get rid of. So I'd visit the neurologist in the next few months, if possible.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
You're
all
welcome.
Right, thanks. Maybe we might talk for a minute about spinal fusion, about in what cases that's an appropriate treatment.
That opens up a big can of worms, as is sometimes said. A spinal fusion means that the patient, with the help of the surgeon, tries to stop the motion at one or more levels in the spine. As I mentioned to your first question, the spine likes to move, with the discs providing the opportunity for motion in the front and the facet joints providing the opportunity for motion in the back. There are some spinal conditions which are so painful, or in some cases where there's instability or abnormal motion present, where a spinal fusion is appropriate. The theory is that if one stops the motion at a given level, that one will stop or at least minimize the pain coming from that spot. So if a person has a fracture that's unstable, a spinal fusion can be quite reasonable. If a patient has a tumor that's eating away the spine and the patient is getting deformity, then a fusion is quite reasonable, and very few people argue with that. If you have a routine backache, however, and a single disc aging before its time, sometimes a spinal fusion is done, but 70%+ of people with a good exercise program, maybe quitting smoking and losing a few pounds in addition, can be so much improved that they don't want to consider a spinal fusion. There are a number of articles in the popular press that criticize us surgeons for doing too many spinal fusions these days. So that's a real hot topic currently.
Yeah. And let me just, we get some other callers here. I promise we'll get to those folks. But I do also want to talk about disc replacement, since we do know that discs do indeed age before their time. And so what you might like to be able to do ideally would be to, if you have someone who's got a disc that's not in good shape, is to be able to go in there and replace it like we are getting to be able to replace some other parts of the body. How are we doing in that area?
We're doing very well. Most of our listeners, of course, know about total hip replacements, total knee replacements. Shoulders are doing pretty good. Elbows are doing fair. Ankles are doing fair. We're moving along medically in helping people with joints that go bad. In the past, all we had were spinal fusions to help with bad discs, so to speak, in the spine. In Europe, there have been 3 or 4, probably 7 or 8 by now, artificial discs that have been available. Some of them have been withdrawn from the market because of tragic circumstances, like the disc being retropulsed back into the spinal cord. So our FDA has been very, very cautious with these things. There are currently no total disc replacements available to the general public. However, there are investigational studies going on at the present time. The 2 artificial discs for the lumbar spine that are being given trials in the United States are the Charité disc and the Maverick disc. For the Maverick disc, for example, there are about 30 centers in the United States that are doing these on an investigational protocol. You have to be a candidate for a spinal fusion at a single level, and then you get your name chosen randomly, and you either get the spinal fusion if you're one-third of the patients, or if you're two-thirds of the patients, you get a disc replacement, and then you're studied for a number of years. There are similar studies are going on in the neck, as I understand it, although that is closer to approval and may have already been approved, but it's not in general usage yet. So I would say that disc replacement is probably 5 years away from general usage with FDA approval if things continue to go well.
All right. We have other callers. Next, we'll talk with someone in Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello. After listening to the program, I'm more confused about what I thought I knew about. Quickly, last 20 years, I went to a company to get a job, and they did the full physical, and I was turned down by the doctor for what was told to me by the health man in the company was a herniated disc, and that since I was going to work in the lab, it wasn't heavy lifting, so I was approved to go ahead with the job. Now, over the years, I've had, I would get a very quick, painful twinge in my lower, usually my left side, and I would get some kind of numbness, usually in my hand, but it would go away, and I've always presumed that was a herniated disc. And since you explained about the herniated disc, I'm beginning to wonder if that was an accurate description of what was actually seen on the X-ray. And I've heard of the slip disc, and I wonder if that would be responsible for, especially after a lot of heavy lifting or something, you hold yourself the wrong way, and all of a sudden, you know, you get that sudden pain. And it usually goes away. It's not, you know, constant. It's just been a few times the last 20 years, but it happened to me about a month ago. And I remember it, and probably remember it quite well. I was just walking normally, and all of a sudden I had a sudden, I don't know exactly how to describe it, but a sudden wave throughout my whole body. And my right arm and hand became numb, not to the standpoint I couldn't feel pinching or anything like that, but it went away within a short period of time, and never thought much about it. But since you were on the radio today, I thought I'd ask a question. If you give me some sort of general outline, I know you can give, you know, specifics.
Sure. In fact, I think a lot of the listeners are probably confused as you are. And we in medicine are mostly responsible for this because we tend to simplify things when talking to you. Also, the chiropractor has a different language than the MD does, and the surgeon also has a different language than the radiologist does. So that's where your confusion is coming from, and I apologize. We really need to get our act together. If we take the words that you've used in the most basic meanings, a herniated disc refers to a piece of disc that's come out of its normal spot, gone back into the spinal canal and is rubbing on a nerve, producing extremity symptoms. You can have a diffuse bulge of the disc, and that's called a degenerating disc, and that's probably what you've got. If that would cause trunk symptoms and some maybe but not major extremity symptoms, at least classically. If you have a piece of disc that's come out of its normal spot rubbing on a nerve, that in the lower back can be called sciatica, it can be called a slip disc, it can be called a herniated disc, it can be called an extruded disc. We have lots of different words that describe about the same thing. Keep in mind that many people have had the same experience you've had. They've been told they have a herniated disc when in fact they have a disc bulge that is not pressing on the nerves. If we take completely asymptomatic people, individuals with no back, no leg, no arm symptoms, and we put them through MRIs of the spine, that's that magnetic resonance study, that's replaced a CAT scan in many instances, 25 to 33% of individuals would have abnormalities on the scan that a radiologist would call abnormal and maybe even a herniated disc.
I see.
So I think that there are a lot of people who are confused, and you at least have degenerative disc disease probably in the neck and lower back, and you may or may not have a herniated disc. But herniated disc pain doesn't just bother you once a year.
Yeah. Okay, now, my significant other says, well, that's easy. You don't do anything. I'm retired, well, for a couple of months at least. And she's saying that I know that your muscles are slack and they're not holding your trunk properly. That's your problem. And I wanted to know if that makes any sense so I can at least settle an argument.
Sir, I never give marriage counseling advice, and I never would step between you and your wife because I'd be afraid you might do that in my house. However, this once, probably never before, probably never again, your wife is right. If you were to get regular exercise, you could minimize the chance of your next flare-up or make it less severe when it happened.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I will start doing those flexors because I found out just going out to the car after a month and lifting a tire is not appropriate action for me, that's for sure.
Yes. Whatever activities you do irregularly once a year, you're more likely to get in trouble from than what you do every day.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Well, just to reinforce something you said earlier, the strength, the muscles that are in your abdomen, your abdominals and your back muscles, they do play a role in providing structure and strength for your spine. So the stronger they are, the better off you're going to be.
Absolutely. I see people with ugly-looking x-rays, ugly-looking MRIs, and they come in with a problem they've had for a week, and I know those changes on the scan and the x-rays have been there for years, and they've been regular exercisers, and that really tends to protect people. Cardiovascular fitness exercise and keeping the trunk muscle strong are of paramount importance.
Yeah. All right. Next up, we have someone in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Regarding a condition of scoliosis, is this amenable to some treatment or does a person just live with it?
Scoliosis is a lateral curvature of the spine and can have a number of causes. About 85% is thought to be genetic. And some sort of inheritance pattern with an environmental trigger usually happens in adolescence. There's also a congenital type that you're born with where the bones are the wrong shape.
This seems to have occurred in later stages of the person's life.
And then there's the so-called degenerative scoliosis, where a person gets degenerative disc disease and facet arthritis, and the spine collapses a bit in an asymmetric fashion, giving a curvature that's often picked up as asymmetry of the waist, a person feeling that one leg is longer than another, etc.
Uh-huh.
It depends on how much it bothers a person what to do with it. If it's merely a cosmetic deformity, then one does nothing. If it gives a person backache, then one exercises and does some of the other general things that help people with backache. If it's a severe problem and it's associated with spurs poking on the nerves, then surgery is often done to take out those spurs. Occasionally, a spinal fusion will be done for an adult scoliosis, but it's not as common as in the adolescent because it's a lot harder for an adult to go through a spinal fusion of that magnitude than it is an adolescent.
Would a brace be supportive and helpful in the case of, to keep it from going too far?
Yes, no, and maybe.
Uh-huh.
You really asked me 3 or 4 questions rolled into one.
Okay.
Can a brace help with the symptoms? Yes. Can the brace slow down the progression of the curve or stop it from getting worse? No. Only in adolescence do we use braces for scoliosis when there's growth left. Once a person's done growing, a brace really doesn't help the progression of the curve. But it could help the symptoms, and so it's worth a try from that point of view.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Champagne next, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Hi. I apologize if you already covered this because I tuned in late to the show, but I just wanted to know about, I have a 15-year-old daughter who is complaining of lower back pain at 2 times. One is during menstrual times, and the other is after she practices on a dance team. And I just wondered if, and we don't have a history of back problems in our family, and she's the only one, she's a twin actually, but she's the only one who has these problems. And I was wondering if you could discuss a proper stretching warm-up thing, and then also afterwards if she complains, am I just supposed to ice it?
Yes, it is common for adolescents to have back pain. I used to think it was rare, but the recent literature has shown that approximately 10% of 10-year-olds and 15% of 15-year-olds have some complaints.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that there's a disc aging prematurely. However, people who do backward bending activities and dance, particularly ballet, does involve a lot of that, can get a problem called a spondylolysis or a crack at the bottom of the spine. It's not life-threatening, can't paralyze a person, but it certainly can cause back problems.
Mm-hmm.
It is not uncommon for a female around the time of the menses to retain fluid. That fluid retention can then irritate the nerves that are already sensitized by another problem, such as a back problem. So what you're describing is fairly common. I think that before proceeding with treatment, it would be ideal to get a diagnosis in the case of your daughter. I think it would be ideal to take her to a primary care doctor and at least get some x-rays of the lower back to see what's going on there. If it looks like there's no surprises, then either her dance instructor or a trainer who deals with athletes or a physical therapist who is used to working with people in her situation should be consulted to get her to the next stage with exercises. But she's probably going to need a hands-on look by somebody to get the right exercises for her.
Okay.
If that doesn't work out, then she would go to the next step with either a CAT scan, bone scan, or MRI of her lower back to look into this in more detail.
So this isn't just normal, write it off, it's just whatever. This is something I should really look at.
If it's me or my child, it is not normal, and I'm not writing it off.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Next is Urbana. Caller on line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I have two conditions in my lower back that I've had in my lower back that I've had ever since I was a kid. One of them is that my lower back seems to be less flexible than my upper back. You know, if I try to touch my toes or whatever, it just seems like my upper back can flex, but the lower back not as much. And then sometimes when if somebody touches me on my lower back, on my spine, right in the middle, it's like I recoil or something. It's like it's super sensitized. It doesn't hurt or anything like that. It's almost like it tickles a little bit. I don't know if that's normal or unusual or what.
Many of us are made differently than others. We look different. We think differently. We're different body shapes. There's a lot of variability. Normally, the upper back in the chest region is the least mobile part of the spine. That's because there are ribs there that limit the motion of the thoracic spine. Also, the orientation of the joints and vertebral bodies have something to do with it, too. But the ribs provide an awful lot of stability. So when one bends over to touch one's toes, the thoracic spine bends a little bit, the lumbar spine bends a moderate amount, and the hips bend a lot. It may be that you had a little early arthritis in your back. It may be that your ligaments are more tight than the average person. But that inflexibility of your lower back may predispose to back problems later in life. So ideally, you would put in a couple minutes a day on your flexibility to minimize a chance of future problems. But it may quite well be normal for you. In terms of the sensitivity to touch, there's some nerve in your body for some reason that is hypersensitive. There may have been some trauma in the past that you don't remember. It may just be normal for you. Neither of these things in and of themselves seem particularly worrisome, particularly since they don't seem to be progressing. So I would probably live with the sensitivity, and I'd probably exercise a bit for the flexibility.
Is any exercise in particular? Any kind of particular kinds of stretches or touching your toes or whatever?
There are a number of stretches that are very good, but I'm not going to be very adept at telling you over the phone. If you want to send me a note at Carl in Urbana with a little note with it, I'd be happy to send you one of our back booklets that will have some basic exercises in them that almost everybody can tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
If those don't work for you, talk your primary care doctor into sending you to a physical therapist for some hands-on and some exercises tailored to your exact condition.
All right. All right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Very good. We have about 15 minutes left, actually a little bit less than that, with Dr. Jim Harms from Carl Clinic. He's an orthopedic surgeon. We're talking about the back. We'll keep taking questions. We'll do as many as we can. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller here is on a cell phone, line number 1. Hello.
Hello. I've had a problem since about February. I started feeling some numbness in the toes of my left foot, which kind of progressed to some pain in the ball of my foot. And then I've had a little bit in the right foot as well. And I saw, a couple of weeks ago, I saw the physical medicine doctor in the Spine Institute. And they did an MRI and didn't find, they did an MRI of the brain as well as the lumbar spine. And didn't find anything in particular as a problem. They said that I had some early degenerative disc disease. But my question is, what's the likelihood of that causing the problem? I have an appointment to see a neurologist, but unfortunately I can't get in for another 2 months.
Somebody's thinking the right way, because when you described your symptoms, of course, since I'm a spine surgeon, I say, can this be coming from the back? The second thing I said was to myself, this could be the nerves themselves. And the third thing I thought was maybe it could be coming from the feet or a localized problem in that location. So I agree that going to a PM&R doctor was a wise thing to do for the initial evaluation and to point you in the right direction. Generally, when a person has numbness in the feet, if it's coming from the lower back, one would have pressure on a nerve. That is, there'd be a spur, a disc bulge, a tumor, or something rubbing on the nerves. An MRI is about 98% accurate in finding those things. And if the MRI didn't show something rubbing on your nerves, then it's very unlikely to be there.
Okay.
The next thing is the degenerating disc. In the old days, we used to think that people like you were crazy. We never say it, but we used to think you were, because we didn't think you could get numbness or pain or weakness in the leg unless there was pressure on a nerve. We now know that it is possible. The current theory is that as the discs age, they produce certain chemicals. If there are microscopic holes in the covering of the disc called the annulus, then those chemicals can leak out into the spinal canal. Classically, that those chemicals go into the small nerves and give back pain. However, sometimes those chemicals go into the large nerves that come out the back and go down the leg and can give pain and sometimes numbness. So the degenerative disc disease could be the culprit. But if it's my back, I go to a neurologist, and the neurologist may need to do a test called EMG and nerve conduction studies. The neurologist might put fine needles in the muscles and check the muscles and the nerves themselves for function in case there's a neurologic problem. If that doesn't pan out, I personally would go to a podiatrist and make sure that I had looked into it as much as possible. The degenerative disc disease as the cause of it is the diagnosis of exclusion, meaning we really need to, we in medicine, need to look for other causes of your symptoms so we can tell you what's wrong, what's likely to happen in the future, and so that you can get some estimate of what kind of treatments might be appropriate.
Okay, thank you very much.
Right. You're welcome. Good luck with that.
We'll press on here to Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about the long-term effects on quality of life of spinal fusion. My granddaughter has had most of her spine fused due to scoliosis, and I'm wondering what effects she might expect as she ages and what she might do to minimize any negative impact.
Well, that's a very good question, and the orthopedic spine literature has a lot of information on that. We think that if you stop motion at one level in the spine, in theory it can concentrate the forces at the level above and level below and accelerate the rate at which those discs age. So her surgeon and the family decided, and she herself decided, that she didn't want to be a bent over little old lady with lung and perhaps heart problems and bad pain from the scoliosis itself, so surgery was elected. We now know that if you leave three or more discs open in the lower back, that seems to protect and minimize the chance of degenerative changes in the lower back later on in life. So those are some general statements or principles. In fact, the same advice that I give for non-scoliotic patients is applicable here. She should try to keep her weight within 20% of ideal. She should not take up cigarette smoking. She should not take up collision sports, although I suspect that's not likely. And she should find a way of working regular exercise into her life.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and again, we'll go to the next, and that's Chicago in line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Hello?
Yes.
If a scoliosis condition is present, would any neck manipulation aggravate it, you know, done by an osteopathic physician?
No. If a person has the routine type of scoliosis that we think is inherited, visiting a chiropractor or osteopath will not affect the scoliosis in any way. That is, it won't make it better, it won't make it worse. If you have a painful scoliosis and the osteopath or chiropractor can help the pain, then it could, in fact, make the scoliosis better. In terms of having a scoliosis and an independent neck problem, I don't think that the scoliosis would be affected in any way by manual medicine techniques on the cervical spine.
Well, see, what he did is he cracked my neck only on the left side, and he pressed a bone around the shoulder blade on the right side, and I got a problem ever since.
Well, I was talking in general, and I was talking about its effect on scoliosis. Obviously, if you take a pill, there's a potential side effect. If you have surgery, there's a potential side effect. If you have manual medicine things done to your spine, there's a potential side effects or consequences. However, the odds of that happening are one in a million or so. Mm-hmm. I think that in your case, if you're having new pain after manual medicine type of experience, that further investigation needs to be done. Your osteopath or your primary care doctor can put you through some x-rays of the neck, some x-rays of the upper back, maybe a bone scan, perhaps a CAT scan. I think that it would be worthwhile to undergo some further investigation to find out why you have that new pain.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And back here locally to our area, Champaign-Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Harms, I think you probably know my sister. She was a nanny for you for quite a few years. I've seen you once, and I know years ago you told me I've had a post-laminectomy discectomy of my lower back, and the thing is about a year and a half ago I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and I'm just wondering, you know, I'm still having quite a bit of lower back pain and shoulder pain and up in the neck area. And I'm just wondering if it could be something due to the fibromyalgia and, you know, the surgery I've had. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yes, sir, and I know who you are. When a person has a disc aging before its time, it frequently causes backache and occasionally some extremity symptoms. When a person has a herniated disc, it causes the extremity symptoms. And of course, as you know, surgery will not make a person 18 again or give them a new back. So some residual symptoms are very common. If on top of those residual symptoms, you're diagnosed with fibromyalgia, that means that your nerves are hypersensitive for some reason. We think there may be a genetic predisposition, again, with an environmental trigger of some sort. But what I might experience as an itch, you experience as a pain. What David might find a mild pain, you would find an incapacitating pain because your nerves send out funny signals. So yes, that can cause low back pain. It can cause shoulder pain. Any kind of trunk symptom is commonly associated with the fibromyalgia. Exercise program and nerve medication are the two things that are most successful with fibromyalgia patients, although nothing works as well as the patient would like.
That's true. That I know. thank you for your input on that, and I'll probably be seeing you before long.
I also heard an ad on the radio for a fibromyalgia clinic in Chicago. I have no other information about it, and I think it was not on this radio station. It was on another one. But there are more and more people interested in fibromyalgia as time goes on, so keep your ears open.
Thank you very much.
All right. We'll try one more here. Mohammed, line 2. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question. I have occasional sciatica, and I've had good results by going to a chiropractor, but I really wonder about the wax that he gives, if that can hurt a person with degenerative spine disease.
Would you explain when you say the wax, was that W-A-X?
Well, it's on, no.
Okay.
No, it's on a table and he puts his hands on and it feels like a whack.
W-A-C-K. Got it.
Yes.
It is quite probable that you have a disc or two that's aging before its time in your lower back, and that that inflammation's going out into the nerves at times. That gives you the occasional sciatica as opposed to a herniated disc, which would give you not intermittent but a constant problem. A chiropractor, an osteopath, or a physical therapist who's well-trained in manual medicine can help with these kind of symptoms, but you need to be on an exercise program to keep the gains that you get with your chiropractor. It doesn't sound like there's anything terrible happening. Are you getting regular exercise?
Oh, yes, yes, and I've been to physical therapy, and I have a lot of exercises. I also have fibromyalgia.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you're doing all the right things then from the patient point of view. And I have no problems with people visiting a chiropractor or osteopath.
Okay. Thank
right.
you.
Well, thank you. There we must stop because we've come to the end of the time. I want to say to our guest, Jim Harms, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be here again.
Dr. James Harms, he's an orthopedic surgeon from Carl Clinic in Urbana. We generally see him in the summertime and talk about the back. And so if you're still in business next year, you'll come back.
If I'm still alive, please invite me.
Okay, we'll do that. Focus 580 made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates. This year celebrating their 22nd anniversary, Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Support for the broadcast also comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine in Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 until 8 in the evening. And Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at corkscrew.com. Susan and Lou Hopkins of Urbana feel strongly that for WILL Radio to thrive, many more people must become contributing members, the Friends of WILL, and they've already made a commitment to WILL this year, but to encourage others to support this valuable resource, they will contribute $10 for every new member who comes on board by June 30th. And you can do that right now in a couple of ways. You can call us at 217-244-9455 with a credit card contribution, or if you're online, just go to our website, will.uiuc.edu, and you can make a credit card contribution that way. Either way, you can help us close the gap here. In the next 2 weeks, by the end of the fiscal year, which is June 30th, we still need to raise another $126,000, and you can help. Every dollar pledged to WILL does make a difference. Well, that's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine, and back today, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll delve into the story of the final flight of the space shuttle Columbia. We'll go to the archives and rebroadcast an interview from February 25th of this year, when our guest was veteran reporter Michael Cabbage, one of the authors of ComCheck, the final flight of Shuttle Columbia. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening in the final minutes.